Not once in 25 years has the government gone to Congress and requested a supplemental appropriation to pay the contracts in full. Not once.
The Arctic Slope Native Association asks the Supreme Court for clarity on government contract payment disputes. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, September 14th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, tracking walrus from the huge haulout near Point Lay.
Everybody says, well, what are they going to do next? And we say, we don't know, because it seems that every year they're playing the game a little bit differently.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Federal Aviation Administration sets standards for the operation of aircraft in airports and provides services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska, so when passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. There's more information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska or toll-free at 1-866-357-4704. This message sponsored by the FAA.
The Arctic Slope Native Association is waiting to hear whether the U.S. Supreme Court will review a case involving underfunded contract payments between tribally run medical facilities and the Indian Health Service. At issue are two appeals court decisions that are at odds. One court says if the government doesn't have enough money to pay the entire contract amount, the affected contractor can't sue. The other court says the federal government must pay its bills in full. Attorney Lloyd Miller is handling the case for the Arctic Slope Native Association, or ASNA. He says the IHS never asks Congress for enough money to fully fund the contracts they award to tribes. For fiscal year 2012, IHS has contracted for $615 million, but is seeking $465 million in appropriations.
That's not right. They know it. They know what's going on in the president's budget, which is this part of the budget is prepared by the Indian Health Service. They tell Congress straight up in a very honest way, we know this is not enough. We know the total requirement is $615 million. We also know that we're not requesting $615 million. And then they ask for Congress's blessing to pay less. This is nuts.
Although Miller says that tribes are the only federal contractors that get short funded, other businesses that contract with the federal government are worried about the conflicting decisions, so much so that the Chamber of Commerce of the United States and the National Defense Industrial Association have filed briefs supporting ASNA's Supreme Court request seeking clarity. Miller says it's unusual for support briefs to be filed before the court has even agreed to hear the case, but he says it's an indication of how worried government contractors nationwide are about what the decision could be.
Because the Federal Circuit, which made the decision that we're talking about, is the circuit that hears almost all government contract appeals. So if that court got it wrong, as the government contractors are concerned they did, then it means a whole new regime for government contractors in the country, and that's not an acceptable outcome for them.
Secretary of Health and Human Services Kathleen Sebelius was in Alaska last month. When asked about IHS contract underfunding, she said historically that has been the case. Contract services have not been adequately funded.
And I think there's no question that the United States historically has never lived up to its treaty agreements. What has happened in this administration is a significant effort to close that gap. We're still not there.
But she says progress has been made, pointing to IHS funding increases each year since she's been secretary, even as other agencies have been cut. When asked why congressional requests are less than the contracts the agency has committed to, she says it's because of the gap that has been in place.
It still doesn't meet. There was such a huge unmet need. So it's one of the agencies out of the 11 under the umbrella of Health and Human Services that has had an increase all 3 years, but that increase is not enough to make up the historic gap. We're just trying to make up for a lot of lost time.
Attorney Lloyd Miller says if the government is running out of money with other federal contractors, such as defense businesses who provide food services or security, they ask Congress for a supplemental appropriation. He says this is what should happen with the tribal organizations that are running hospitals in Oklahoma or Alaska.
But the government never does it. Not once in 25 years has the government gone to Congress and requested a supplemental appropriation to pay the contracts in full. Not once.
Officials with the Arctic Slope Native Association did not respond to repeated requests for comment. It will likely be October before the Supreme Court justices announce whether they will review the case. Walruses are hauled out near Point Lay in huge numbers again. Federal scientists estimate tens of thousands of animals came to shore in Alaska in late August as the sea ice retreated. It's the fourth year since 2007 walrus have hauled out in the U.S., but their behavior this year has been a bit different. APRN's Annie Feit has the story.
When Anthony Fishbach arrives at the office each morning, the first thing he wants to do is check on the walruses. In late August, the USGS biologist helped put satellite tags on 34 animals near Point Lay, and now they're offering a window into walrus behavior in the Chukchi Sea.
I come in the morning, it's like, I really want to process the data so I can get some view of what they're doing, and it's really been surprising me. I keep expecting them to do what I've seen them do in the last few years, and they're doing something different.
Last year, the females with calves hauled out near Point Lay, made short foraging trips from shore, and then swam south and west to Russia. This year, most of the USGS tagged animals left Point Lay and went north on long foraging trips, 7 to 10 days in open water.
They're traveling from these beaches where they've been resting to these offshore locations. They're foraging there. It's unclear how they maintain contact with their calves in the open water conditions there. And they have no place to rest.
Now, many of the tagged animals appear to be heading back to Point Lay. Fishbach says no one knows what will happen from there.
Everybody says, well, what are they going to do next? And we say, we don't know, because it seems that every year they're playing the game a little bit differently. We don't know if that's because they're simply learning how best to play the game of being a walrus in the absence of sea ice, or because they're responding to potential depletion of their feeding resources and they're having to shift their distribution around in response to that. We don't have the data on that to really assess what's really going on.
When walrus congregate in such large numbers, trampling deaths can occur if the herd gets spooked by a loud noise and rushes to the water. Fishbach says he found a dozen dead calves on a beach near Point Lay, but the cause of death is still being investigated. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is asking airplanes to steer clear of the haulout, and Fishbach says residents of Point Lay are helping protect the animals.
In Point Lay, people regularly get on the VHF radio and make calls out to people, say, be very careful in transiting this area, stay away from walruses on shore. So there's a lot of active management that's going on at the local level there.
Fishbach has been studying walruses since 1995, and in that time he's seen incredible changes in the population, especially in recent years.
But, you know, as a wildlife biologist, it's a bit eerie to see such a radical change in a species distribution and behavior.
He says the changes are concerning, but what they mean for the population long term is still a big unknown. The data Fishbach and colleagues are collecting right now on the walruses near Point Lay will help give a better picture of how they're responding to a changing environment. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
The commander of Fort Wainwright Stryker Brigade is expressing condolences for soldiers killed and injured in Afghanistan, but says the unit is making progress. Colonel Todd Wood spoke with reporters via teleconference from Afghanistan yesterday. The press conference followed news of another Stryker soldier death, the 12th to be killed since the 4,000-member unit deployed in April. Colonel Wood says despite the losses, brigade morale remains strong.
The things that we have seen and done in a short period of time have been very rewarding. The soldiers are genuinely into this mission, and they're working very hard to make this place better and working very hard to accomplish their mission, which is to provide that kind of security, which is going to allow this country to transition to complete independence.
Wood says the Strykers have moved from Zabul province to Kandahar province since arriving in southern Afghanistan. They are nearing the end of the summer fighting season in a rural agricultural region. Wood says Taliban fighters do not engage Stryker soldiers and their Afghan counterparts in battle and rely instead on IED attacks.
He knows that in a stand-up fight he's going to lose, and the IED is something that he can put in the ground and then remotely detonate that from a safe distance and get away.
Other IEDs blow up when driven over by vehicles. The explosions have taken a deadly toll on the Stryker Brigade, but Wood says many incidents have been averted.
Our find rate on these is well over 90%, and with the equipment that we have right now out there, the detections are very frequent, and we continue to find where they make these IEDs at and destroy those facilities. Been very successful in that in the last couple of months.
Wood says the Stryker's mission is security-focused and involves working alongside and training Afghan Army and police, both of which have taken on more leadership in preparation for the drawdown of U.S. forces. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, heading out on an expedition with small kids.
The kids are actually pretty portable, and so we started, you know, basically figuring it out as we went along, and you can do a lot with kids.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
Over 90,000 Alaskans sought food assistance from food pantries and soup kitchens in 2010, some only once, but the vast majority more than once, sometimes in the same week. KSKA's Len Anderson has more on efforts to help with the increasing numbers of food-short Alaskans.
On Monday, the Anchorage Chamber of Commerce hosted three panelists battling hunger in Alaska. One was Anchorage School Superintendent Carol Como. She pointed out nearly 40% of Anchorage's over 48,000 students qualify for free or reduced lunches and breakfasts. Food Bank of Alaska statistics show over 41,000 Anchorage residents needed food support at least once during last year. The majority needed more assistance. Martin Howard represented the business community. Howard is manager of the Southside Walmart. He said for years the corporation simply shipped on-purchase foods to landfills. Now, in advance of the expiration dates, the company trucks the food to places like Bean's Cafe or the Food Bank of Alaska.
At the Diamond Store this year so far, we've donated from January until August 126,082 pounds. 126,000 pounds is a lot. Whenever you consider just a couple of years ago, we were donating zero.
Howard says his store is part of a statewide corporate effort.
Last year, here in the state of Alaska, Walmart donated 500,000 pounds of food to our food bank partners. And it's 426,000 meals with a value of $880,000. That's just right here in Alaska. That's nowhere else, and that's with 9 Walmart stores and 3 Sam's Clubs.
Howard noted that Costco and Fred Meyer's has also taken an active role fighting hunger statewide. But the executive director of Food Bank of Alaska, Susanna Morgan, says as participation increases, so does need.
Donated food we run out of, or we go through, on a very regular basis. If you donated a can today, I will bet you it is gone tomorrow. We distribute 3,000 pounds an hour.
That hourly rate adds up. Last year, Food Bank of Alaska distributed 6.5 million pounds of food. About 2.5 million went outside South Central Alaska. That latter amount brings up the question of shipping costs.
We do get donations from Alaska Airlines, Northern Air Cargo era, but most of the food we ship goes by bypass mail and we pay the costs. It averages about 38 to 40 cents a pound compared to 7 cents a pound by truck.
The food bank ships not just to the rural hub communities, but also into villages throughout the bush. Morgan said there are several ways to help fight hunger in Alaska. First, one can volunteer at a food pantry or soup kitchen or at a holiday distribution. Secondly, there's money.
Make a financial contribution to any of the great organizations that do anti-hunger work. And frankly, your dollars go farther than your food does because I can buy more of it than you can because I'm buying by the truckload.
Not that Morgan advises against group food drives.
We're always delighted to get that food that way, too, especially if you're working with kids. Food drives tend to be very fun, very tangible ways to be involved.
The panel's appearance before the Anchorage Chamber of Commerce was part of Hunger Action Month, which locally includes several educational and food collecting events. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
Metlakatla's fishery has been certified as sustainable by the Marine Stewardship Council. That should help the Southern Southeast community maintain salmon sales overseas. As Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports, it's the first tribal fishery to earn the certification.
Metlakatla is a Tsimshian community on Annette Island, about 15 miles southwest of Ketchikan. It's an Indian reservation, and its tribal government controls fishing within 3,000 feet of its shores. Its fisheries used to be included in the Marine Stewardship Council's certification of Alaska waters. But a few years ago, that changed.
The certifier examines the management of the fishery as part of assessing to the standard.
Carrie Coughlin is the council's regional director.
So when it became clear that the Metlakatla fishery was the only small part of the Alaska salmon fishery that's not managed by ADF&G, then it became clear that they couldn't be covered under the certificate because the management of the Metlakatla fishery had not been assessed.
So community leaders decided to pursue their own certification. Jeff Moran runs Metlakatla's Department of Fish and Wildlife. He says the move was motivated by economics, but that wasn't all.
We had certain markets that we had been selling fish to that came back and said, well, you know, we won't be able to buy your fish unless you are certified. So, I mean, that was one of the primary factors that drove us to seek certification. But then once more we started looking into it, the more it became obvious that it seemed like the right thing to do.
Metlakatla hired Scientific Certification Systems of California to handle the review process. Coughlin of the London-based Stewardship Council says it's lengthy and detailed.
There are 31 different scoring indicators in the MSC standard under three different principles around sustainability of the stock and the impact on the marine ecosystem and the ongoing management of the fisheries.
The council certified Metlakatla's pink coho chum and king salmon fisheries earlier this summer. That will maintain European markets that require proof of sustainability. Moran says that's important to the 50 to 70 gill netters and 10 to 15 seiners working out of Metlakatla.
A very, very significant percentage of the community rely very, very heavily on fisheries. And then on top of that, we also have our own processing plant. An Alaska packing company, which hires many people for processing the product.
Marine Stewardship Council staff traveled to Metlakatla to celebrate certification in late August. But that's not all that has to be done. Coughlin says the review process recommended some changes that will help make the fisheries even more sustainable. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
A pair of Vancouver-based mining companies in a joint venture to explore the Herbert Glacier area near Juneau say they've found high-grade concentrations of gold. Herbert Glacier, 18 miles north of downtown Juneau, is smack dab in the middle of the historic Juneau Mining District, with the Kensington Mine now operating 25 miles to the north and Greens Creek Mine about 12 miles to the west. Ian Clausen, president and director of Grand Portage Resources Incorporated.
It's not a well-known fact, sure it is to Alaskans, but not to many others, that used to be the largest gold mining district in the world. So this is a gold-enriched system that we find ourselves in. We're not surprised overly by finding multi-ounce recoveries because we know that these mesothermal-type veins have a hallmark of running on for distance and at great depths and for continuity. We're not overly surprised. We're just very comforted by some of the success we're having thus far.
Clausen says they're consulting with their field geologists to determine future plans such as further exploration. He says it's way too early to come up with a resource estimate.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Business Monthly Magazine, publishing statewide news for over 26 years from Alaska's business sector, government, and industries. Information and subscription online at akbizmag.com. The law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by
AT&T, rethink possible. Details at att.com/Alaska or 1-800-252-7266.
Kotzebue is one of 24 sites around the world featured in a 24-hour event today to raise awareness about climate change. Former Vice President Al Gore founded the Climate Reality Project as a global campaign to mobilize people to help solve the climate crisis. 24 presenters will give speeches on climate change in each time zone around the globe. Larry Schwager, president of the National Wildlife Federation, will give the talk in Kotzebue at 7 p.m. Alaska time. He says he'll focus on the startling number of extreme weather events that have struck the U.S. in the last year.
You know, the U.S. should be asking a very profound question about our future. Are we setting the stage for greater and greater storms, greater and greater droughts? These are the signals that scientists warned us a long time ago to be on the lookout for, and we're seeing them today. And we need to understand that we're going to see more of that as time goes on.
Schwager knows there are a lot of climate change skeptics in the U.S., and he acknowledges it may be impossible to convert a small segment of population that adamantly believes human-caused climate change does not exist. But he thinks events like the Climate Reality Project can have a big impact on average Americans.
I think what we need to focus on is the middle. We need the average American to understand that things are changing. You know, and it doesn't matter whether you rely on fossil fuels to get back and forth to work. It doesn't matter whether your electric is produced by coal. What matters is that we all realize that we need to change our basic energy usage and move to a new energy economy.
The Climate Reality Project speeches start out in Mexico City this evening and wrap around the globe to finish up with a talk from Al Gore in New York City tomorrow. Other sites include Auckland, Jakarta, Seoul, Dubai, and Beijing. A family of Kachemak Bay adventurers is at it again. After hiking and pack rafting the Chukchi Sea and the Northwest Arctic last year, Brettwood Higman and Aaron McKittrick are departing their comfy little yurt outside Seldovia, this time for a two-month odyssey across Malaspina Glacier in southeast Alaska. KBBI's Aaron Selbig reports.
Brettwood Higman and Aaron McKittrick's latest adventure begins Thursday when the couple heads to Yakutat for an epic hiking and camping trip across Malaspina Glacier, the largest glacier in the world outside of Antarctica. The massive 40-mile-wide glacier first caught the couple's attention back in 2007 when they crossed it as part of a 4,000-mile year-long journey along the coast of Washington State, British Columbia, and most of southeast, south central, and western Alaska.
We're going there partly because it's a really quickly changing glacier, like a lot of them, but it's just really dramatic because it's so large.
Higman and McKittrick have been planning the trip for months and seem to have thought of all the details, including how they'll get 2 months worth of food out into the wilderness.
We're going to charter a plane out to our start point, and we'll stop at actually 3 points along the way and go and do hang, so to keep the food from getting eaten by the bears, and then our route will kind of reverse that flight and go past those points on the way back.
They'll also be bringing along a pack raft, a satellite phone, and a portable electric fence to keep the bears out of their campsites. The couple's 2-year-old son, Katmai, is ready for the trip as well.
Where are you going to go, Katmai?
I'm going to go to Malaspina Glacier.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
That's right. Little Katmai and his 15-month-old sister, Latuya, are going along on the trip, too. If you're a parent of small children listening to this right now, there's a good chance you're thinking, really? Two kids on a 70-mile, two-month trip across a glacier with winter approaching? Or at least that's what I was thinking. But Higman and McKittrick are unfazed. They've carefully considered all the challenges and have come up with some pretty innovative solutions. They've made their own rain gear and neoprene boots for the children, for example, and they have a plan to make a lightweight, baby-carrying rickshaw out of alder branches and a bicycle wheel.
When we first had Katmai, we didn't realize that we could continue to do all this stuff with kids. We're just like, oh, I wonder, how old he'll be before we'll be able to, leave him with grandma and do some more trips. And then we're like, oh, this kid's actually pretty portable. And so we started, basically figuring it out as we went along, and you can do a lot with kids.
It's a little bit challenging to interview Katmai about the upcoming adventure. He seems more interested in my microphone than the questions, But he did say he is excited to go on the trip with mom and dad, and he seems to be looking forward to the food they'll eat.
I'm going to eat dry strawberries.
You're going to eat dry strawberries?
Yeah.
And what else are you going to eat?
I'm going to eat pineapples.
Oh, yummy. That sounds good. And what are you going to do on the trip?
I'm going to eat some peas.
Some peas?
So basically, the entire trip will be one big feast, at least according to Katmai. For Higman and McKittrick, a big part of the trip is a hope to draw attention to climate change, a phenomena that McKittrick says seems speeded up at Malaspina Glacier.
It's just a lot more dramatic there than it is in most places because you have this gigantic glacier and you can see, you know, it shrinking away and the waves coming in and the dramatic erosion that makes the maps that the USGS made totally useless. So we're going to do a few very specific things, like reoccupy some photos from the 1890s and some that we took a few years ago. But more, we just hope that people can experience climate change in a way that makes it seem more real.
You might be able to follow along with the Higman-McKittrick clan as they make their way across the glacier. The couple is hoping to at least occasionally use a satellite phone to connect to the outside world and post updates on their website, groundtruthtrekking.org. In Homer, I'm Aaron Selbig.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Len Anderson in Anchorage, Ed Schoenfeld and Matt Miller in Juneau, and Aaron Selbig in Homer. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health, and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance. The Federal Aviation Administration sets standards for the operation of aircraft in airports and provides services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska, so when passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. There's more information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska or toll-free at 1-866-357-4704. This message sponsored by the FAA.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.